Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Take on a mission to unlock the real magic of that great Coca-Cola taste, updated with a twist. New limited edition flavor Coca-Cola Ultimate has been co-created with League of Legends. Taste the plus XP and level up by serving it ice cold for maximum refreshment. Scan the QR code on the bottle for unique digital and IRL experiences. League of Legends. Coca-Cola. Try new Ultimate Limited Edition flavor.
Hi, I'm Hannah, and I'm very excited to be hosting What in the World, a new daily podcast from the BBC World Service, where we try to help you make sense of the world around you, of the big things that are happening, the small things that are happening, and everything in between. Just search for What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 5th of August, these are our main stories. A court in Russia has sentenced the jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny to a further lengthy term behind bars in one of the country's toughest prisons. West African states have agreed a plan for potential military intervention to restore democracy to Niger. A wildfire in the Iranian capital sets off explosions outside the Evin prison. Also in this podcast, at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland, the one-woman show with an audience of one.
I knew it was preview week. I knew it was going to be hard. It all just came out afterwards, and that's when I had a cry.
Keep listening for a happy ending. We begin in Russia, where the country's most prominent opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, who's been imprisoned in a remote penal colony since 2021, has been found guilty of extremism charges and had his prison sentence extended to 19 years. It's understood he'll now be taken to one of Russia's highest security prisons to be subjected to a special regime, likely to include longer periods of solitary confinement. Friday's court proceedings were held at the prison in Melikovo, from where our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg sent us this report.
For this court case, the phrase behind closed doors feels like an understatement. Alexei Navalny was tried in the high security prison in which he's currently incarcerated. The proceedings were closed to the press and the public. But for the verdict, we were allowed in to penal colony number 6. Journalists crammed into a small room dubbed the press centre to watch on a video screen. We weren't allowed into the makeshift courtroom itself, the prison hall, where the Kremlin's most vocal critic and Russia's most famous prisoner was pronounced guilty yet again, this time on extremism charges. Although due to the poor quality and intermittent audio being pumped into the press room, it wasn't initially clear to journalists here just how long the new prison sentence was. Alexei Navalny and his supporters insist he is a political prisoner. A charismatic protest leader and anti-corruption crusader, Mr. Navalny fell foul of the Kremlin long ago. In recent years, he's been the only opposition leader in Russia capable of bringing large numbers of people, especially young Russians, onto the streets nationwide in anti-government protests. In 2020, in Siberia, he was poisoned with a nerve agent and airlifted to Germany. He claims the Kremlin had tried to kill him. The Russian authorities deny it. On his return to Russia in 2021, he was arrested and jailed. Ever since, it's been trial after trial, prison sentence after prison sentence.
Steve Rosenberg. Well, in a statement posted on Facebook, Alexei Navalny urged Russians to keep up the fight. He said, "You are being forced to surrender your Russia without a fight to a gang of traitors, thieves and scoundrels who seize power. Do not lose the will to resist." A spokesman for the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner, Volker Türk, said the sentence imposed had been based on weak charges.
Mr. Türk noted that the 19-year sentence was based on vague and overly broad charges of extremism and followed a closed trial on the premises of the prison where Mr. Navalny is already serving two other sentences amounting to 11 and a half years. And he called on Russian authorities to take measures to respect their human rights obligations by immediately ceasing violations of Mr. Navalny's human rights and releasing him. And the Secretary General supports the Human Rights High Commissioner on this.
Vladimir Ashurkov is executive director of the Foundation Against Corruption, founded by Mr. Navalny and now based in the UK. And he gave Julian Marshall his reaction to the sentence.
It was expected in today's oppressive environment that Putin has created. Today's sentence is the next step in persecution of Navalny. His first sentence was given to him actually 10 years ago in the summer of 2013. And then in 2020, it was followed by assassination attempt and incarceration after he returned to Russia in January 2021. And now this ridiculous sentence.
What do you know about his physical and his mental health? Because he's in for a tough time, isn't he?
Yes, he is in for a tough time, but the last 2.5 years were not walk in the park either. He is in harsh conditions of Russian prison, and prison authorities make it a point to make life difficult in prison for Navalny through various means. But nevertheless, Navalny sends from his prison cell the message of truth, the message of encouragement for Russians. And in his last words, just a few days ago, he was encouraging Russians to do whatever little they can to confront this war and this dictatorship.
In those comments earlier this week, he said the purpose would be to frighten Russians with this lengthy prison sentence. Will that be the case?
I think Russian authorities do feel the need to frighten people. And a regime that doles out such ridiculous sentences, I mean, 19 years is more than many murderers get. And Navalny gets it just for words and for being a political force. I don't think such a regime is quite confident in their legitimacy and in their stability. So indeed, they have a feeling that they need to frighten people.
Do you think, though, that Mr. Navalny still has the support in Russia that he once had, and particularly at a time of war?
Well, it's difficult to put a number on the levels of his support. You know, in today's environment, when people are afraid to talk to pollsters, people get fines and are arrested often by doing a single person picket with a blank piece of paper. We can judge by objective factors. If we take 2013, the mayoral elections, Navalny, despite all the obstacles, he got almost to the runoff round against the incumbent mayor with 28% of votes versus 50%. So I think since then, an average Russian would only feel more disillusioned with the regime, which have seen the standards of living stagnating or deteriorating, familiar international brands leaving the country, international travel restricted, and for the last year and a half, a constant stream of coffins coming to Russian homes from the battlefields of Ukraine.
Vladimir Ashurkov, executive director of the Foundation Against Corruption, founded by Alexei Navalny. Well, meanwhile, in the war in Ukraine, a Russian Navy ship has been towed into harbour after what Kyiv says was a strike by one of its sea drones. The vessel, a large landing ship capable of carrying battle tanks, was listing heavily and appeared to be low in the water. It was struck off the Black Sea port of Novorossiysk, hundreds of kilometres from Ukrainian-controlled territory. Ukraine security agency says it used a surface marine drone armed with nearly half a ton of explosives. Russia said it had repelled a drone attack. From Kyiv, our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
In waters dominated by Russia, Ukraine relies on stealth when it comes to striking Russian targets in the Black Sea and Sea of Azov. In footage sent to the BBC by sources in Ukraine's security service, an onboard camera captures the moment a sea drone moves towards a Russian warship in Novorossiysk. The video breaks up at the point of impact when it's designed to detonate. Pictures taken in daylight, which have been verified, suggest the damage was heavy, with the vessel leaning towards the side and being towed to shore. The Novorossiysk port is a major export hub for Russia and an important naval base for its Black Sea fleet. It's not clear how much harm it will cause Moscow, but Ukraine's allies have always been nervous about this war spilling beyond its borders. So, has that stance relaxed? From what senior presidential adviser Mykhailo Podolyak says, it seems so.
It is clear that it is impossible to win the war if you are not actively attacking. You can't just watch it happen. We are at war. Our partners have already realized it is not just a small conflict. War is war. It is necessary to destroy the capabilities of the other side.
Ukraine has promised more sea drone attacks and hopes they will put Russia off from flexing its muscles on the Black Sea. It's clearly trying to counterpunch where it can, but with Ukrainian ports being pummeled by Russian drones for the last fortnight, this isn't tit for tat.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. In the early days of the invasion of Ukraine, experts were surprised how poorly the Russian army's electronic warfare units performed. But nearly 18 months later, they're causing significant problems for Ukraine's counteroffensive. In this so-called invisible war, Russian systems can affect even the most sophisticated weapons that Ukraine has received from Western allies and NATO countries. The BBC's Abdjalil Abdurasilov reports.
A Ukrainian soldier's focus is deeply concentrated on watching blue waves on a computer screen. Occasionally, he jots down something on a piece of paper. Then he picks up a radio and reads out coordinates of Russian artillery positions. This scene in a damned basement could be from a movie. And it's probably not a coincidence that the soldier's call sign is Alain Delon, like the famous French film star of the 1970s. Alain is a member of an electronic intelligence unit. His job is to monitor emissions, signals used by drones, air defense systems, multiple rocket launchers, and other weapons. He says that Russian forces constantly hunt down units like his. Their mission is part of a hidden confrontation called electronic warfare. Most modern weapons have electronic devices that use radio waves, microwaves, infrared, and other frequencies to send or receive data. That makes them vulnerable to detection and suppression. Alain and his team climb on the roof of an abandoned house and set up an antenna. His unit's work helps to build a picture of the battlefield. Colonel Ivan Pavlenko, chief of Electronic Warfare Department of Ukraine's General Staff.
If I see a number of radios in the same place, I understand that it's a common post. If I see that something changed or some radios begin to move ahead, I understand that maybe it would be a counteroffensive or offensive.
After a poor performance at the beginning of its full-scale invasion, Russian electronic warfare systems today are significantly slowing down Ukrainian counteroffensive. Brian Clark, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, believes that changes in the dynamics and location of the war are the reasons for that.
Russia has deployed, for example, Zytel, which is their GPS jammer. They've deployed those every few dozen miles along the front. And then Russian communication jammers are deployed at even greater numbers than their GPS jammers. So you're talking about hundreds of jammers right along the front lines to jam the radio communications that Ukrainians depend on to coordinate this counteroffensive.
Russia has significantly improved its capabilities to jam satellite links like GPS, and that is already hurting Ukraine a lot, because most modern weapons they receive from NATO countries use a GPS signal for navigation. When suppressed, even high-precision missiles and rockets can miss their target. That is why both sides are on the hunt for each other's electronic warfare systems. The unit's position is compromised, so they need to change their location. The key in electronic warfare is being invisible to your enemy.
That report by Abdul Jalil Abdurasilov. Countries from the West African regional body ECOWAS say they've now agreed on a plan for possible military intervention in Niger if the military, who seized power there, don't restore the country's president. The organization had earlier set a deadline of Sunday to reinstate Mohamed Bazoum. ECOWAS Commissioner for Political Affairs, Peace and Security, Abdel Fattah Moussa, says this operation is being coordinated at the highest level.
ECOWAS is not going to tell the coup plotter when and where we are going to strike. That is an operational decision that will be taken by the heads of state who are going to be like the commanders in chief of this operation.
ECOWAS is also attempting to mediate. A delegation visited Niger on Thursday but failed to meet the coup leader or the deposed president. Correspondents say military intervention would be logistically extremely difficult and risky, as it could cause further destabilization in a region already badly hit by jihadist insurgencies. The government in Ethiopia has declared a state of emergency in the Amhara region in the north of the country after days of clashes between National Defence Force soldiers and local militias. The Prime Minister's office says constitutional order there is under threat. Telecommunication links have been cut, making it hard to verify details. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross told us more.
There's a great deal of unhappiness in Amhara because during the two-year Tigray War, the Amhara backed the government. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed got a lot of support from Amhara people who took up guns and went to fight against the Tigrayans. But after that, as part of the kind of let's make up and find peace, there was an agreement, or at least a decision was taken, to get all the guns off the Tigrayans and to get the guns off the Amhara, who were part of basically a state-backed security force. And they felt, well, you take away all our guns now after we've helped you, we're then going to be very vulnerable to attacks, not only from Tigrayans if they choose to attack us, but also there are land disputes with the Oromo. So there's a lot of things going on here, but the Amhara feel very badly let down by the government. And so right across parts of the Amhara region now, in the small villages, there are these local militias who are basically causing chaos and trying to make the state look ungovernable, it seems.
And those are the Fano?
Those are the Fano. So they are people who know the terrain very well, difficult for outside troops to come and defeat them. It doesn't look as though they're trying to capture large towns, but they did for a few hours. They managed to seize the airport just outside Lalibela town. Today we understand that flights have been cancelled to at least three towns across the Amhara region. So that gives you an idea of the sort of chaos they're causing, even if they don't have the wherewithal to hold on to the key strategic towns and cities.
And do you think the Ethiopian government's attitude is that this will have to be sorted out through talking?
Certainly, that was the initial call from the president of the Amhara region. He said, we're open to dialogue, we want dialogue. But within 24 hours of saying that, he sent out an appeal to the federal government and said, this is spiralling out of control, we need extra measures, please help. And then we got this state of emergency. But as some people have pointed out, one of the problems will be with dialogue is who on earth do you talk to? You've got hundreds and hundreds of tiny kind of neighbourhood, almost vigilante groups that have sprung up. They don't have an overall leadership, so it might be very difficult to solve this through dialogue.
Will Ross. Now to Iran, and a wildfire caused by high temperatures has set off explosions outside Tehran's notorious Evin prison. The blaze has now been brought under control. Here's Mike Thompson.
Iranian state media say the blaze, which began in grassland, detonated landmines in a security zone around the jail. The facility is the main site for holding political prisoners, as well as foreigners and dissidents who took part in recent nationwide protests. A fire there last October ripped through a section of the jail, killing at least eight people. It's been a week of scorching weather in Iran, with temperatures topping 50 degrees Celsius.
Mike Thompson. Still to come.
A century ago, there were as many as 1 million mating pairs of the small black and white bird on the coasts of southern Africa.
But now the number of African penguins has dropped significantly. So will a fishing ban help stop their decline?
from the passion of the fans.
Yes, so what did you think of the match though?
Oh, the match was amazing. It was so nice to see so many Nigerians coming up.
To the atmosphere of the competition.
The game, the crowd, the atmosphere was absolutely amazing. I am now a converted New Zealand fan.
World Football at the Women's World Cup is the podcast from the BBC World Service capturing all the excitement of the tournament here in Australia and New Zealand. Listen now by searching for World Football wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Negotiations are continuing in the Colombian capital, Bogotá, over whether Nicolas Petro, the son of President Gustavo Petro, should be placed under house arrest or held in prison. This is after he admitted channeling money from a drug trafficker to his father's presidential campaign last year. President Petro says he knew nothing about the illegal activity and ordered a police inquiry last March. I got more from our Latin America correspondent, Luis Fajardo.
Nicolás Petro is accused of having taken money from a convicted criminal who once served a sentence for drug trafficking. And moreover, he says that part of the money he took during the presidential campaign of 2022 actually ended up as campaign funds, which, of course, is a criminal offence.
And what about his father, the president's role in all this? Did he know about it?
That is the crucial question that many people in Colombia are asking. President Petro has denied any wrongdoing. He has also said that he respects what the judiciary might decide about his son, but he says he had nothing to do with it. It certainly has created already a huge political crisis for President Petro, perhaps the biggest corruption scandal in decades in Colombia, where a lot of people have criticized him, particularly because of what he stood for when he ran for president. Again, he was the first ever left-wing president of Colombia, and he had run explicitly on a campaign against corruption. And now a lot of people are accusing, of course, his government of not having lived up to this ideal and this hope. And this is creating a very big political crisis, which many people are afraid that will cause many problems in his intentions to implement a very ambitious social reform agenda. Now they think he might be forced to spend the rest of his presidential term defending himself from these attacks.
And what is his son saying about these accusations?
Nicolás Petro again has said that he personally received these funds. He has already confessed to authorities. He entered a plea bargain deal with prosecutors in which he agreed to give more information about corruption in the campaign in exchange for leniency. Again, the very damaging remark he says is that part of this money, not only he kept for himself, but he also had it enter campaign funds. And in that sense, he would have contaminated, I guess, the presidential campaign that elected Petro.
And where is Nicolás Petro now?
Nicolás Petro is attending judiciary proceedings in the capital in Bogotá. And later today, judges are expected to decide if they grant him the benefit of house arrest instead of being directly sent to a jail. If he is convicted, he would face many years in jail.
Luis Fajardo. Now to South Korea, and thousands of children attending the World Scout Jamboree there have been moved to hotels because of a heat wave in the country. Temperatures soared to 35 degrees Celsius at the campsite near the southwestern town of Buin this week, leading to hundreds of young people requiring medical attention for heat-related illnesses. The authorities are facing criticism for failing to prepare adequately for the international event. Our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie, reports.
40,000 scouts from around the world descended on a plot of reclaimed land to camp for 2 weeks during a blazing heatwave. A lack of shade and air conditioning have been blamed for hundreds of teenagers needing medical attention. There have been complaints about the facilities, the food, and the access to water. Some have saved for years for this once-in-a-lifetime experience, leaving parents angry and concerned. One parent, Peter Noldrit, said South Korean officials weren't prepared for the event.
Obviously, they knew that there were 47,000 young people coming from all over the world, and there have been issues with sanitation, there have been issues with not getting enough drinking water, just basics, really, like not having enough food.
The government here has been hastily trying to turn things around, promising to send air-conditioned buses and medical staff.
Jean McKenzie in South Korea. In China, there's been a break in the storms that have caused widespread flooding and extensive damage, leaving at least 21 people dead, according to the authorities, and more than a million people evacuated from their homes. The decision was taken to try and take pressure off the capital, Beijing, by diverting the water. As our China media analyst Kerry Allen explains, that led to neighbouring areas paying the price.
It's absolutely devastating. There have been many reports over the last week talking about how Beijing and neighbouring Hebei province have seen some of the worst flooding in decades. So a report today, the Xinhua News Agency says that the Haihe River Basin, which encompasses these two regions, has seen the worst flooding since 1963. And the water depth is around 2 metres deep. And there have been attempts to try and offset this by releasing water into surrounding regions, largely regions outside of Beijing in Hebei province. And this had devastating consequences. And there's no sign that the water is going to subside anytime soon. It could take at least a month to do so.
So they diverted the water away from the capital. What happened?
In Hebei province, there has been flooding in particularly a city called Zhuozhou, and it has led to more than a million people have been relocated in Hebei province. And it has led to a lot of frustration, but also a lot of fear, because there are elderly populations in these regions. And a lot of the media that I've seen over the last few days that has dominated Chinese national broadcasters and in newspapers has been small children, also the elderly, being rescued from these cities that weren't badly affected by the flooding and then suddenly saw their houses destroyed.
And yet we have certainly one person in authority proudly declaring that the province of Hebei would act as a moat to protect Beijing. What's been your reaction to that?
There has been obviously a lot of criticism of this, but what happens in China is that whenever anything happens like this, and flooding is very common this time of year, you'll see an emphasis on the positives in terms of the huge community efforts of people to come together and to try to help. So lots of media footage very much focusing on firefighters, relief workers, people within these communities cooking and looking after people. So a lot of focus on the positives rather than on the negatives. And this has been a long-running thing in China, that you'll often see this rather than criticism of the government. In fact, on social media platforms like Weibo, it's very common to see criticism of the Communist Party be censored.
Kerry Allen. Here in Britain, a court has found a social media influencer and her mother guilty of murdering two men who died when their car was rammed off the road. It followed a dispute over an affair between one of the men and the mother of TikTok star Mahek Bukhari. Navtash Joha reports from Leicester in central England.
Mahek Bukhari wanted to be known as a social media influencer, spending much of her time on TikTok. But it was the events in her life offline that have now made her infamous.
Where was that?
This is a video she didn't post online. Police body cam footage of her and her mother's arrest on suspicion of murder in February last year. They arrived at this point due to a 3-year relationship between her mother, 46-year-old Ansreen Bukhari, and 21-year-old Saqib Hussain. The court heard that when Bukhari broke off the affair, Saqib Hussain threatened to send sexually explicit material of her to her husband and son if she didn't repay him money that he claimed he'd spent on her. In response, the jury were told that the mother and daughter hatched a plot with the help of others to seize Mr. Hussain's phone containing the explicit material. He agreed to meet them in Leicester under the belief that he'd be receiving payment. He was driven there by his close friend, Hashim Ijazuddin. But the proposed meeting quickly became a deadly chase, with Mahek and Ansreen Bukhari and their group in two cars following the two young men in their vehicle.
On the A46 is where the crash took place. Just beforehand, Saqib Hussain was on a 999 call, telling the operator that he was being followed by people wearing balaclavas. He says, "They're trying to ram us off the road. Please, I'm begging you. I think I'm going to die."
Mahek Bukhari, her mother, and two others have been found guilty of the men's murder, while three others were convicted of manslaughter. They will be sentenced next month.
Navtaj Mohal. South Africa says it will introduce a 10-year ban on fishing near colonies of critically endangered African penguins. Ministers are warning that unless action is taken, the birds could be extinct by 2035. As Theo White reports.
A century ago, there were as many as 1 million mating pairs of the small black and white bird on the coasts of southern Africa. But today, it's believed this number has fallen to just 10,000. African penguins are, like all penguins, flightless and rely on the sea for their food. Barbara Creasy, South Africa's environment minister, says competition for fish is thought to be a major contributor to their decline. It's hoped that by stopping fishing around six key locations, the species can be brought back from the brink of extinction.
Theo White. And now to Scotland and the Edinburgh Fringe, the world's largest performance arts festival, which has just kicked off. Thousands of shows are being performed in all sorts of venues. For actors who are less well known, it can be hard to get noticed. So, spare a thought for Georgie Greer, who performed her one-woman show on Thursday night with only one person in the audience. She shared a post about it on social media, and the reaction has been overwhelming. Georgie Greer told the BBC what happened.
It's preview week, so I knew it would be a struggle for numbers. I had eight on the first day, so I was like, well, that was a really good turnout, feeling, you know, optimistic, although I know it's a marathon, not a sprint. But each time again, you get nervous. And then there was a bit of a conversation outside of the theatre where my technician came out, and I was like, he's never normally out here. What's he doing? And it came to that, you know, there was just one person there, and I was obviously quite upset, but I knew it was preview week. I knew it was going to be hard, but I just thought, you know what, I have to get on with this. I have to treat this like a dress rehearsal. But then I think it all just came out afterwards, and that's when I had a cry. I didn't want to call my mum crying, so I thought the hashtag EdFringe community on social media has been a really supportive place. And I thought, oh, you know, might find a couple of other people who had one person, might get some words of comfort from someone else, might be able to comfort someone else who had one person. I did not expect the level of reaction. It's been so lovely, so unexpected, so many words for what I've experienced. But yeah, I'm just so appreciative of the support. So I've got to do it for the rest of the month, including today. But it's put a spring in my step for sure. But of course, there's no guarantee still of ticket sales. I love the support, but I will never know who's there until I walk into that theatre, and will be grateful if anyone turns up.
Well, Georgie has now done her next show. So how did it go?
It went really well. There was more than one. It went really well. It was so nice to have people's smiling faces there. And I'm so grateful to each and every person who came.
Ah, that's a nice ending. Georgie Greer there. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Paul Mason. The producer was Leo McSheffrey. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye. We'll be right back.